The following interview features Toronto-based artist and educator Charmaine Lurch.
All right, I'm Charmaine Lurch, and I'm a visual artist and arts educator and parent and lots more. And I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if we should start by maybe if you could speak about the show at the ROM, Here We Are Here, that you're a part of.
It's about to open, so that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited by the work that I produced in the way that it's not work that you would normally see from me, in that it is drawings, a series of charcoal drawings. And really, my line is my drawing off the canvas. So it is work that you have seen, but you haven't really seen my charcoal out for a while. And so coming back to this, I would say the basics of seeing and looking and observing was actually quite challenging. You know, and I did about 200 drawings to get five drawings that I, you know, fairly happy with. And so it was a wonderful practice to go back, to move forward. And I think it's, you know, I played with my wire after, and my wire has improved. So I really like that process of moving different materials and mediums in a different way. And to be part of the show, because, you know, I was in some of the early protests out of Africa. And so I feel like I've come kind of in a circle again.
Right.
And to have my work in that place. I've been in the ROM twice, and really, they were great shows, but it didn't really move my work. What I think is important in this case is the response to not just that show, but to Black artists, Blackness in Toronto and Canada. There are a whole bunch of conversations, and there's a lot of synergy, a lot of connections between the other artists. It was lovely to be in a room with them all and hear them, so that was really, really lovely, and speak to them. And then, you know, we each go off into our individual practices, but you will see the connections, definitely.
So I wonder if we can go back and backwards first, and two things. One, if you can talk a little bit about how you became an artist, and then the second was, we'll pick up on that really important moment here in Toronto when the Royal Ontario Museum did Into the Heart of Africa, and how controversial that show was, and the issues it raised, and the impact it had on artists and curators and a number of folks that we are actually talking to in this series. But let's talk about how you got started as an artist.
I think because my voice was silenced in so many ways, and I was really small and quiet, and I always talk about it being almost invisible, you know, because of how I looked, but also because I was very quiet. And so I started to draw, and, you know, children with enough encouragement just kind of continue what they're encouraged in doing. So I just kept drawing, and it became my voice. And I always, I call it digging where you stand. So I'm with my family, whether I'm with my family, if I'm traveling, that's the kind of art that I'm being informed by, and I'm creating around that. And so, you know, I just felt like I always drew. And I'm still drawing. And I just started to... I really loved a three-dimensional practice. I mean, we are 3D beings. There's that book, Flat Stanley, when I'm in school. You know, I like Flat Stanley, but I always want him to pop out. And I really like that world, the three-dimensional world. I always like to also think about the future, but not, you know, as a futurist or anything, but what next? What are we to become? What will my artwork become? I'm always interested in, you know, what that's going to look like. And so along with that, you know, drawing three-dimensional practice, I'm always thinking of a future practice. And, you know, Oprah is always following me, I always say, because...
Are you running for president?
I can't say right now. But, you know, I did work for years on Henrietta Lacks. Even before that, on Nelson Mandela when I went to South Africa. And then she did a whole thing. And then the school in South Africa. And then I did the work on Henrietta Lacks. And then she did her thing on Henrietta Lacks. And I've been working on the Tesseract, which is a part of the Wrinkle in Time, because I read that book so long ago and it really influenced me. So a Tesseract is a... a fourth dimension hypercube, and it's often in my work as almost as if we are fish in a bowl. We can see one, two, and three dimension, but we can't quite see the fourth dimension. Or if you think when people thought the world was flat, and then when we could get off it, we could really prove that it was oval. And so I'm always thinking about that, and my wire helps me to, because there's so much in wire when you put it together, so many spaces and holes, that to me, that's kind of like the tesseract that you're trying to imagine.
When we say drawing, people will think of like charcoal and graphite and pencil on paper, which you do, but your drawings are also three-dimensional and move out into space, and you work with wire and copper wire, and you do these remarkable gestural forms in space. I think about your bees, right? So maybe talk a little bit more about that, and then back over to Liz with other questions. Yeah.
So I love my bees, and I love working with bees for so many reasons. You know, pollination, and we get food, and all of the things that we already know. But for me, it's a metaphor, an analogy for blackness. And it, you know, when I start to talk about it, people are always like, how do you combine those two seemingly different things? But I always think, you know, we're part of the environment, just like bees are. But also there's that aspect of the invisibility of bees and how they're seen and understood. And I'm talking about, I mean, honeybees are great, but I'm talking about native wild bees that are around us that we don't see. So there's that invisibility part, but they are helping, you know, with our plants and our flowers and are doing so much. And, you know, but if a bee is kind of outside in its place, it's okay, we might be a bit afraid, but if it comes in to a space that's, it's just another space, but we've created this box, it's not allowed to come in, it becomes this thing that's, we fear it, it's becomes this other big thing that's dangerous. And I think that's how, for me, blackness is understood as we move through different spaces. So it's about space and perceptions of bodies in space. And so my bees help me to think about those kinds of things. And the wire itself catches that sense of invisibility of the bees. And then if you add the lighting to that, it, you know, throws this amazing shadow on the wall, so the, all the wire pieces. And then the tesseract comes in, where if you see a bee, my sculptural bee, and it's sideways, it looks like an insect, you know, but if it turns and it's end on end and it overlaps like a tesseract, it's hard to see that it's a bee until it comes into focus again. All of those overlapping things are what I use to understand my own self and my work.
And would you say working with wire is engaging the tesseract in some ways?
Yes. Like,
and so that is will always be a part of your practice?
Yes, always, yeah. It's, and I love the wire because it's, it has memory, like muscle memory, and it's also unpredictable. It's sometimes it won't go how I want it to go, and then it will, something else will come out of it that's I hadn't imagined, you know. So yeah,
amazing. I'm kind of interested in the idea of visibility and invisibility, and how Black artists and curators, that we're always aware of that, like of being invisible and creating space and making ourselves known and visible. And there's also, I guess there's like kind of a frustration in our work always having to be a response, I find. That our work is always centered around, or often is centered around, this challenge of visibility and invisibility. So I'm just wondering if you feel like that's something that you have to respond to, you choose to respond to. Does it feel like at odds ever with your personal expression?
It's always at odds, my personal expression. I've come to kind of embrace that kind of invisibility in the guise of a tesseract, because it has been a way of life for me for so long that you learn to live with it, or you learn to move with it, or try to change it. And so in this show at the ROM, in my thesis show, because I, as a mature student, I went back to school at York University, and I decided to think about invisibility as always in flux. So we are always visible and invisible simultaneously. And depending, you know, if we want to be seen or if people want to see us. And so for me, that it's a conversation in flux. Mm-hmm. We are always in movement and change. And so this installation at the ROM, I called it Being, Belonging, and Grace. So I wanted to just think, like the bees give me a moment of just being. I'm not a black artist. I'm mm-hmm. when they're always surprised when they don't know me and they see the bees. I'm not creating black art. I'm mm-hmm. just creating art. And so in the ROM, I wanted to think about just being. What is it when we're just allow those moments of joy, of conversation, and it gives us a sense of belonging, mm-hmm. which we're not pushing against something as a response to, even though, so it's a, there's a duality here in the show where it is a response, but I also wanted to bring us back to not having to respond, being belonging and grace, not graceful, but how we grace a landscape when we are allowed to just be. Mm-hmm. So that is how I've kind of taken back visibility and invisibility simultaneously.
I want to pick up on that. I was talking earlier with somebody about Tim Whiten, artist who's been here in Toronto for years, came from the U.S., born in Detroit, and Tim had talked about a kind of certain frustration at a certain point of only being invited in to respond, mm-hmm. like to not be invited in as like, Tim Whiten is a really important senior artist who's mm-hmm. taught so many people in the city, but the opportunity to have an exhibition at a place like, say, AGO or whatever, it's never really about Tim's work. It's about, oh, could you come and respond to mm-hmm. the collection of African art? Mm-hmm. So is that an experience, do you think, has been common for you, that you feel like when you are reached out to, it's more about, oh, we need, like, please come because of this context as opposed to being an artist? Mm-hmm. And do you think that is common to the experience of black artists in Toronto?
I think so, most definitely. And not that we don't need to speak out and want to at times, but yeah, to be invited just to talk about, I don't know, the universe, mm-hmm. something would be, I think, is important. It's kind of a negation of what else we can bring mm-hmm. to the table. I mean, the bees allow me to be asked to talk about pollination and bees and things like that, so they mm-hmm. allow a kind of escape almost. But and you know, it's been happening for so long personally that, and I didn't even realize it until I went back and looked. I used to, well, I still do, I illustrate books, sometimes anthologies, sometimes children's books, and I went back and I looked at the books like when I first got out of school, and I didn't even realize it, that all of the books that I got to ask to kind of add my voice to and illustrate were always black content. So I was never, I just went out there as an illustrator and I didn't even realize, you know, so happy to get a job. When I looked at the body of work, but then I thought, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. look at that. I mean, I really wanted to illustrate Nikki Giovanni's poem, you know, but I didn't get asked to do any others, mm-hmm. you know, so that's, and I see it. Mm-hmm. It's and from early on in my, all the way up to now. So.
Maybe that, I mean, having said all that about responding, I don't want to lose that thread of where earlier it came up about that ROM exhibition, Into the Heart of Africa.
Yeah.
Because you had said you were an active part of the protests about that. Mm-hmm. For folks that don't remember, this was a big exhibition that looked at the collections of the Royal Ontario Museum of African material and how it came there. And one of the big issues around it was developed without any kind of dialogue or consultation with the community, and also that it perpetuated, you know, in attempting to be like contemporary and academic and ironic in some ways, it actually perpetuated a great deal of pain and harm, mm-hmm. right? So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it still surprises me that they put that together, and yeah, without any input, without anything, I can barely talk about it. And the fact that it took so long to get that recognized, to get any kind of apology or real acknowledgement, that's also problematic in that the time it took. Mm-hmm. And then,
was it not like 25 years?
And then I think now it's almost 27 since this. And since then, they've been doing some exhibitions to answer that. And I think that's a good thing, a good move forward, but there's so much work. Yeah. That's all I'm going to say. There's so much work to be done in that, in so many of the institutions, of course, and it's good when people are able to take a step forward, but they took so long to take that step, so I'm still...
I think what was disturbing, too, about that wasn't just the lack of response from the institution, but also this sort of academic museum world, curatorial world, actually rallying to the institution's support in a lot of ways. So it actually percolated through many debates at conferences for years, rather than, it seemed such a clear-cut wrong, but it was actually debated.
Yes.
As like, oh, well, it's actually the community's fault for not actually understanding what they were doing or whatever. I want to come back to your bees and talking about the world and love and nature. Right?
Yeah.
So, Liz.
I'm interested in your relationship to different materials.
I have to say that, just to start off, that my work to me is, I can see the connections, and a lot of people see lots of different and a variety. Which it is, but there's always sort of I'm going to call it a planemeric surface, always like a plane or a map, a flat plank, always sort of an elongated thing. The carriage made up of three of those. And within those within those forms, different things happen. So I'm talking about negative space, which is kind of a kind of invisibility that happens in the carriage. And then the surface, I'm always thinking of... the earth or the ground or something in nature. So, and I love metal, and the wiring is part of that. So I'm always looking for, I love working in metal and welding. I can weld. And so I found this, Maker Sculpture Studios, who I've been working with for years. They are so fantastic. They were able to help me find this kind of metal paint that actually rusts and you have to retard it. There's like 5 steps to seal it. And it's non-toxic, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
fairly non-toxic. And so I've been using this kind of medium in my work along with the wire. And so there's always the plane and there's always a recessed or a relieved surface. And sometimes that surface that comes right off and, there might be a background. It could be a wall, but there's that structure and something comes out of it. The use of wire, really, as I said, I draw all of the things, like we all do, we sketch it out and then it becomes the line off the page, which I'm just manipulating. So those are the main things. I'm also a painter and I love to mash paints together in color. And that often I add wire to those painted surfaces. So again, the painting and the relief. And one of the ones that I still love that I still get asking me to do is is it my son or my husband? I forget. And I have his face, but it's the hair that's all wire. So the face is painted. The hair has wire. It's my son Julian because there's a cello in there somewhere. And there's all kinds of things. So I'm telling about this young black boy's life in his hair, but through wire and just indications of things that you might pick up or not.
The piece that you were just describing that was in the exhibition Every Now Then, Reframing Nationhood, that I co-curated with Anik Jordan, who we'll also be talking to.
And thank you for that.
It was fabulous.
Yeah. I'm going to interrupt you and say that I felt honored to be in that show with those artists at this time.
Oh, good.
The work in there was so sublime. So rich to meet some of those people, to hear what they had to say and to see the work was so moving for me. It was a gift and thank you for that.
Yeah, it was amazing to have you to be part of it.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask if you could talk a bit about the story that's behind that piece, the sculpture. You talked about the carriage, and it's a piece that makes reference to the Thornton and Lucy Blackburn. And if you could talk a little bit about that, because that also crosses over into illustration work, your teaching, you're done collaborating with writers and so on. So maybe if you can share what was once a very invisible story, but is becoming more visible.
And Catherine Kittrick talks about, she's writing about the burial ground in New York. And she talks about the taxonomy of decay and all of that stuff and all the things that get covered but are still there. So this work with the Blackburns, as you said, was erased, invisible for so long, and yet it was such a rich part of history. So Thornton and Lucy Blackburn were, I would say, the first known black entrepreneurs in the city of Toronto. They owned houses in the ward. Mm-hmm. They were active in politics. They helped enslave people when they came to Canada and put them up and helped them get started. So they were really community-minded, involved in politics with George Brown. They're mm-hmm. buried beside George Brown. So yeah. Obviously there was some kind of relationship there. And, you know, and a lot of their money went to Little Trinity Church when they left. They left quite a fortune, actually.
Yeah, in those they lived times. So modestly, yeah, but like they left did. A lot.
Yeah, and, you know, they had a They had they grew things. I was thinking the bees are involved in that. I was wanting to involve the bees in that. And they could not read, but they were highly intelligent people who carried on a business. Lucy Blackburn ran the business. Thornton right. Blackburn did the actual driving of the carriage.
Yeah, so the first yeah. the carriages they started the first taxi company
yes.
in Toronto.
Yeah, right, and the colors of the TTC came from their taxi. So they're still, I think, living amongst mm-hmm. us in those colors and those things. And so, I mean, theirs is a fascinating story of escape and espionage and yeah. Okay, it's such a rich story, I'm sure. Well, if Oprah lived here, she would make a book of it.
Or be in
a movie of it or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it will be a movie one yeah. day. I think it's worth it.
So there is a book. I just sort of back it. They were fugitive slaves from Kansas.
Kentucky.
Yeah. And the book, I've Got a Home in Glory Land, captures that.
Yeah, yeah. Carolyn Samard Frost did a lot of research. So it came out of a dig. That the Toronto District School Board did in the east downtown Toronto. Mm-hmm. It was their property, and actually they, if you read the notes in the archives, they were actually asked as a black couple if that property could be taken for one of the first schools, Inglenook, in Toronto.
Yeah, that's right.
And usually, you know, they wouldn't normally be asked, so it just showed that they were quite mm-hmm. upstanding, well-loved citizens in yeah. Toronto. And so, and Thornton also worked at Osgood Law School. He was a server and so worked there for years. And I think an astute businessman, because it's those very people who would later take his taxi. And so he had it built from some schematics in Montreal, which I tried to find but couldn't find. So I created mm-hmm. my own. I have my own blueprints from just mm-hmm. from the words. And it's Carolyn Samard Frost who did a lot of the dig, a lot of the research in the States to connect Canada and the United States. You know, we've been working together since I did a reading of her book, and I my whole family went down on our bicycles, and we were like the only ones there for the first reading at Inglenook School. And you know, we asked so many questions, and we kind of made a connection because my kids were just love that story. And I find that students are really, really drawn to that story. When I had first put the carriage out, it was part of my, it wasn't fully developed, it was in its first stages as part of my thesis show. And I had it out, and we had some students come from the Jane Finch area. And, you know, I was walking around and talking to them, and then this little guy came up and said, could he sit in the carriage? And then I said, okay. And he just sat in feel, and he was so happy because he loved the story. That's what he said, he really liked the story. And just going to talk about quickly my arts education. So a lot of what I do is community based, and I think those students are brilliant. I get some of my best ideas from them. So when I go into the schools, based on the book, there was a package made for the school as well, and I started years ago teaching about the Blackburns in the schools, and then we'd create work about around that. And it was lovely because I could do that outside of Black History Month, whereas in the schools, mm-hmm. I often got asked to come in Black History Month, which is okay, but we need to be broader than that. Mm-hmm. And also my bees, too. I mean, we talk about pollination and food. We are creating small bees or pollen grains in the school to talk about, you know, the plight of the bees or just bees in general. And so a lot of my work... And the Henrietta Lacks, I bring petri dishes and actual tools that scientists might use. And I talk about this black woman who, you know, is in our lives every day. If you even get a needle and mm-hmm. HPV vaccine for the high school students that they get, can tie right back to this, you know, black woman who at first they didn't even, they call her Helen Lane because, you know, they didn't want you to know that she was Henrietta Lacks. Mm-hmm. And right. So, yeah, a lot of, it's pretty exciting it's research for mm-hmm. them, but it's also, you know, my own research brought forward into shapes and objects that I create, but also that they create and, mm-hmm. and own. So it's, I love that, that relationship that it allows me, the students to, and it becomes even richer still.
I wanted to ask you about the balance, because you introduce yourself as an artist, an arts educator, and a parent, and of course so many other things. And I find that so many artists, especially nowadays, you know, you can't solely be an artist and, you know, afford a normal lifestyle in mm-hmm. Canada. I'm just interested in, it sounds like you have found this really beautiful balance and that all aspects of your life.
I love you for saying that.
Chaos.
There is no balance.
Yeah.
There's a film called Koyen Statsi.
Oh, yes.
Hopi
yeah.
translation
yeah.
is yeah. life out of balance.
Yeah.
And I just live yeah. that life out of balance. Things get moved around and mm-hmm. shoved, and I try and in flux bring everything up at some point, but mm-hmm. never. I am always out of balance, and it's a difficult existence. There's something beautiful about it as well. I don't know any other way to be. It's tiring, mm-hmm. and I am fortunate to have a family that supports this kind of way of being. Mm-hmm. You know, if I didn't have that support, I couldn't be this kind of artist. So mm-hmm. I understand artists who, you know, I have a husband who, you know, can support me in many ways, mm-hmm. but I always feel the need to also bring in, and for my own, I need to bring in some kind of, you know, support for the family. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying to balance that, but if I didn't have a more steady support, mm-hmm. and I see it with my artist friend who are brilliant, but they might not have that support. Mm-hmm. But maybe they give up something else, and mm-hmm. then just trying to be with my family, you know. Mm-hmm. I am always working, like many people, but I'm always working, and I find that tiring. I would like to sometime yeah. just, you know, I can't even go away, a retreat or mm-hmm. an artist's, you know, I'm not very good at getting any, I always get rejected from what do you call those?
Residencies.
I think I'm too honest. I got to talk yeah. about blackness. I should never say that. I got to yeah. stop saying that.
No, don't stop.
Well, I've never got a residency, and I think that's why, honestly. Not in all of them, because, you know, but I'm, and I blame it probably on my writing, maybe.
It's very
that could be it, yeah. but. I think it's time that I went yeah. away, and my kids are growing. I'm still somewhat at home. And I think, you know, if you have kids, that's also my art.
Yes.
You know, and so yeah. I need to give yeah. her time as well.
There's a friend of mine, Kiana Mestridge. She's in New York, and she did her master's thesis project was a book called How We Do Both, mm-hmm. and it's on artists that are mothers, and she kind of sent out this survey to a number of prominent artists and just kind of talking about the balance, how do you make money, how do you have time for your work, and I think it's perfect when you say life out of balance, because I think in all of these interviews, they're all... Like, no one, everyone's looking for this answer, like, mm-hmm. oh, so you just wake up and do your work, and then mm-hmm. you have the rest of the time for your kids, or, you know, whatever. Of course there's no clear path, and it is always exhausting, but I do think that there's something I think it's really important to, like, acknowledge that it is out of balance, and to just be okay with that, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to make it fit a certain mm-hmm. form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My very old friend who passed away, I think in 97, he said, when you die, you rest.
So can we, maybe just one more question that relates to family and which is something I was really struck by once seeing you give a talk, and your daughter was there, and she came up, and she was part of the talk, and you were doing a drawing, and I have two daughters, and I think lots of people know they've always been like a very much part of the work, like creators in the work, collaborators, and that sort of thing, and that's always been really important I can't imagine the work I've done over the years being as rich and rewarding if it hadn't been for their participation in it, like all the collaborators. But anyways, we have had conversations with some folks, and this came up last week with you in the conversation with Cozy about homegoing, and I'm just curious if you'd like to talk a little bit about relationship to your in your family. Is all your family here? Do you still have family in Jamaica? Like, what the relationship, is that a factor for you in your work at all?
It's a huge factor. I can start with, you know, when I'm dragging my own work around, doing my own curation and shows, my husband always says, can you just work smaller? Because I'm the guy that's hanging, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He's renting the truck and taking those big pieces and hanging them on the wall. And, when I went to the AGO, I said, oh, you should thank Andrew, because I got to stand back and everyone just kind of hung it. I said, you know... Usually I'm, you know, lifting it and he's lifting the other end. So, you know, they're right in there with my work. I mean, when the kids were smaller to even now, you know, I'm rushing to finish a show and, you know, just paint the edges of the canvas there or just do that. Blow dry it. You know? So they're used
to work.
Yeah, I put them to work. And in this being belonging and grace at the ROM, it is my daughter. And it's a lovely overlap in that her middle name is Grace, but she is there posing. And when I looked at her, I thought, this is what I'm seeing, the being belonging in Grace. When she's just doing a backflip in the house, she's not thinking about being black. She's not, she is just being. And I thought, this is what I want to capture. This is what we need more of. You know, before we've grown and life just presses on us, we have to, I really wanted to capture what it means to be black in this moment. And that's what it means when it's a beautiful glimpse of that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're very much a part of my work. They work hours. My mother's in there wrapping. I have pictures of her, and you know, I'll invite my sisters and the neighbor. Like, it's such a community. I call them all my family. All the beekeepers come in to help me with my work, and they are invested. They ask me, like, where is my bee? The language changes, right?
Yeah,
it's lovely. It is your bee. Mm-hmm. You know, I get to put my name on it, and hopefully, you know, they can see that I list them in my show if they've worked on it even before past beekeepers. I try, because I cannot do this work alone. I mean, the charcoal drawing was the most alone I've been, but then my daughter posed for it, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of my work is, I would say, immediate family and extended family that is involved directly, and their hands are in it, and so I just love that.
That's great. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's so nice to see you, and thanks for sharing and being part of this series of conversations.
Oh, it's great to be able to talk so freely about my work.